Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Islamic State leader with ties to Paris tragedy is killed. The U.S. military says an Islamic State leader with direct links to the alleged ringleader of last month's terrorist attacks in Paris was killed in a coalition airstrike in Syria. A coalition spokesman, Colonel Steve Warren, speaking from Iraq, said in a news briefing today that Charafi al-Mudain was killed last week on December 24th.
He was a Syrian-based ISIL member with a direct link to Abdelhamid Aboud, the Paris attack cell leader. We killed him on December 24th in Syria. Al-Mudain was actively planning additional attacks against the West.
According to Colonel Warren, it's been a good month for coalition forces.
Over the past month, we've killed 10 ISIL leadership figures with targeted airstrikes, including several external attack planners, some of whom are linked to the Paris attacks, others had designs on further attacking the West.
Meanwhile, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi visited Ramadi Tuesday after government forces recaptured the government compound in a key western city. Iraqi state television reported that the prime minister was in Ramadi but offered no other details, but an Iraqi military officer told the Associated Press that the prime minister met with security and provincial officials. The fall of Ramadi to Islamic State in May was a big blow to the prime minister's government and military. The United States says the killing of a top Syrian rebel leader complicates efforts to bring a ceasefire and political resolution to the country's nearly five-year conflict. Zahran Alush, the head of a group called Jaish al-Islam, died in an airstrike Friday that was claimed by Damascus. This is VOA News. Zimbabwe's economy ends 2015 with predictions that prices will continue falling in the new year. But as Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA from Harare, economists say that that trend may not benefit everyone.
Most Zimbabweans seem to be worse off today than in 2009 when the Southern African nation abandoned its worthless currency and started using multiple currencies. After years of staggering inflation, there is now deflation in Zimbabwe. But John Robertson, an independent economist in Harare, explains that is not the good news it sounds like.
Deflation is normally associated with people having money to spend, but choosing not to buy the things they want because they will be cheaper next month. What's been shrinking in Zimbabwe is the buying power.
Robertson says the government should be shrinking its activities. Sebastian Mofu, VOA News, Harare.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. A Russian vessel carrying more than 11,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium has left Iran for Russia, part of the international nuclear agreement reached with Tehran. It's a development hailed by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry as a significant step toward full implementation. Israel's Supreme Court ruled today that former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert will serve 18 months in prison instead of 6 years in connection with the 2014 bribery conviction. Mr. Olmert has denied any wrongdoing, and the court agreed to the sentence reduction after he appealed to the original verdict. When he reports to prison on February 15th, the former prime minister will become the first former Israeli leader to spend time behind bars. State prosecutor Lenat Ben-Ari says justice has been served. She says the case represents a watershed moment in the war against corruption in Israel. The justice system has sent a strong message that no one is above the law. Mr. Olmert became prime minister in 2006, but the case dates back to his time as Jerusalem's mayor in the 1990s. Prosecutors say Olmert and others accepted money to push the controversial Holy Land housing project and help its approval, which included zoning law changes and tax breaks for developers. A suicide blast in Mardan, Pakistan, has left at least 18 dead and more than 20 wounded. The blast in the city northwest of Islamabad occurred outside the door of government office called the National Database and Registration Authority, which is responsible for issuing national identity cards. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhiben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization has declared the West African country of Guinea free of Ebola transmission. WHO says this marks an important milestone in the two-year struggle to stop the spread of this deadly disease, which has claimed the lives of thousands of people.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, the Associated Press reports the death toll from two Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria yesterday has risen to 80. And 20 soldiers have been arrested in Burkina Faso for allegedly planning to free accused coup plot leader General Gilbert Diendere.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization has declared Guinea free of Ebola. This marks an important milestone in the two-year struggle to stop the spread of the disease, which has claimed the lives of more than 11,000 people in West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Guinea has passed 42 days without a confirmed case of Ebola, making it the third of three severely affected countries after Liberia and Sierra Leone to have stopped the spread of this deadly disease. This is also the first time all three countries have halted the original chains of transmission of Ebola since the virus was first detected in Gekedu, Guinea in December 2013. Director of Ebola Response and Coordination at the World Health Organization, Richard Brennan, calls this a significant achievement, but he warns the disease could reemerge. He tells VOA, Guinea and other countries in West Africa must not become complacent. They must remain vigilant.
Between March and November this year, we've had 10 mini outbreaks of Ebola, what we're calling flares of Ebola. And they have occurred due to reemergence of the virus in individuals because of persistence of the virus in survivors.
Dr. Brennan explains the virus may remain in the semen of some survivors for as long as 9 to 12 months, during which time Ebola could be sexually transmitted. Therefore, he says, Guinea now enters a 90-day period of heightened surveillance to make sure new cases are quickly identified before they can spread to other people. He says WHO will actively monitor the situation in Guinea as well as in the other West African countries.
We will maintain a presence in every prefecture of Guinea, every district of Sierra Leone, and every county of Liberia for the next 12 months. We will have to support local healthcare workers in the prevention, detection, and response to potential outbreaks.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa was the worst in history. It was unprecedented in scale and complexity. Since the onset of the disease in March 2014, 11,300 people have died in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and more than 28,600 have been infected with the virus. The World Health Organization does not rule out future outbreaks of Ebola in the West African region. It acknowledges many mistakes have been made, but many lessons have been learned in the course of dealing with this epidemic. Consequently, it says Ebola medical response teams now are better placed to detect and respond quickly to future outbreaks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reuters news agency reports 20 soldiers have been arrested in Burkina Faso for allegedly planning to free accused coup plot leader General Gilbert Diendere. Outgoing Prime Minister Isaac Zida says the suspects were taken into custody in Ouagadougou yesterday. He alleges they plan to free the general and up to 57 others being held for the September attempt to overthrow the government. Meanwhile, former banker Roch Marc Christian Kabore was sworn in as president today. He was elected last month, breaking decades of rule dominated by the military.
The Associated Press reports the death toll from two Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria yesterday has risen to 80. Nigeria's Emergency Management Coordinator says more than 50 died in Maiduguri when three pickup trucks loaded with militants attacked the city. Maiduguri is the capital of northeastern Borno State. And in northwest Adamawa State, residents say two suicide bombers killed 30 people at a bus station in Matagala. However, the military has not confirmed that figure.
Education has been hard hit in several West African countries because of attacks by the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. A recent UNICEF report says 1 million children are unable to attend class because 2,000 schools have been closed in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. The military is encouraging children who fled after their schools were destroyed in far northern Cameroon to return. Some are seeking education in safer locations. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports.
Kwene Ekwele, one of the senior commanders of Cameroon troops fighting the Boko Haram insurgency, pleads with villagers of Kerawa on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria's Borno State to send their children to school. He says the Cameroon military is meeting the villagers to assure them of their protection from Boko Haram fighters and encourage parents to send their children back to school from wherever they are hiding. He says they are fighting Boko Haram so that every Cameroonian child should go to school, every farmer should work freely in his farm, and people should go around freely. He says the villagers should have confidence in their military. The remote Kerewa village has been a war zone since Boko Haram extended its attacks from Nigeria to Cameroon in a bid to create an Islamist state 3 years ago. Two schools in the area were burned by the insurgents in December last year. Ibrahim Joel Muhammad, Cameroon's Far North Regional Delegate for Basic Education, says hundreds of the village's schoolgoers fled to safer locations in Cameroon's hinterlands.
Il y a 33,000 élèves déplacés. Ce qui est sûr, au début de...
He says since the month of April this past year, more than 33,000 primary school children have been displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency in the far north region of Cameroon. Among the students who have escaped and are seeking education in safer areas is Mbwake David, the 17-year-old, now studying at a government bilingual high school in Marwa, does not imagine returning to his village soon. He says he cannot risk his life by returning to his village where there is war. He says the best thing was that he ran for his life. Philomene Mebenga, one of the head teachers in Marwa, says they have received instructions from the government of Cameroon to admit all children fleeing Boko Haram, even if classrooms are congested. She says the children, like all other Cameroonian children, need education and as such should not be denied that basic right under the pretext that classrooms are already congested. She says she encourages the children not to lose hope and tells them they will be able to go back to their villages when peace returns. In March 2015, Cameroon launched an $8 million emergency plan to construct schools in safer locations away from volatile areas overrun by Boko Haram. 200 classrooms, dormitories, and latrines for 70,000 students were to be built. This month, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, said more than 2,000 schools have been closed in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, while hundreds of others have been attacked, looted, or set on fire by Boko Haram fighters in their quest to create an independent Islamic State. Both Cameroon and the UN agency have been expressing fears that lack of education may fuel further radicalism, especially now that Boko Haram has been recruiting child suicide bombers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Voters in Central African Republic are scheduled to go to the polls tomorrow to elect a president and parliament. The nation has been divided by sectarian fighting since rebels ousted President Pierre Bozizé 2 years ago. Despite militia threats of violence and secession, the nation's voters overwhelmingly approved a new constitution 3 weeks, paving the way for tomorrow's vote.
There was more violence in northeastern Kenya yesterday. Two civilians were killed when Kenyan military officers fired on a car in the Mandera region. Other incidents have raised concern about safety in the region, where Al-Shabaab militants from Somalia are known to be active. VOA's Jill Craig speaks with analysts about what this violence means for Kenya's security.
The Mandera region in far northeastern Kenya has experienced a rash of attacks in recent weeks. On December 21st, Al-Shabaab militants shot at a passenger bus and then attempted to divide the passengers into groups based on religion, Muslim or Christian. 6 days later, militants killed two police officers and injured several others. The next day, Kenyan soldiers shot and killed two motorists they suspected of carrying weapons. Three others were injured. This violence is only the most recent in a region of Kenya that borders troubled Somalia. A year ago, Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 28 non-Muslims traveling by bus to Nairobi. Richard Tuta is a Homeland Security and counter-terror expert in Nairobi.
So those who are intending to attack those areas, they have realized that there are some soft spots. There are some gaps that are existing within the security systems in Mandera.
Some of those gaps may be the result of the Kenyan intelligence community's limitations when it comes to quickly acting upon information. Mwenda Bajiwe, chief executive of Ion Security, a Nairobi counterterrorism consulting firm, says that proper resources have not been allocated for intelligence officers who work without weapons or handcuffs.
So they are still operating like they were 2-3 years ago, where they see the suspect and just point at him.
Tuta says that with the splintering of Al-Shabaab militants into Islamic State and Al-Qaeda supporters, the factions are competing to sustain their relevance. And this, he says, helps to explain the recent surge of attacks in Mandera.
So when they compete against each other for relevancy and for prominence, they become more lethal. And that's why you can see that all of a sudden there is an increase in the numbers of attack.
Additionally, Tuta says these attacks may be a sort of decoy to distract the security forces from other locations.
So that all the attention now is focused in Mandera, then we leave a soft belly in Nairobi, Mombasa, or our own major town, for them to carry out a very major attack.
That said, Bajiwe with Ion Security argues that Kenya's security community has worked hard to stay ahead of terrorists.
For instance, since mid of last year, there has not been a single terrorist attack in the city of Nairobi. Prior to that, there were always sporadic attacks. Just about 2 weeks ago, there was an attempted, bombing of a public bus, but it didn't kill anyone. And so there has been tremendous improvement.
And for Kenyans throughout the country, they hope the improvement continues. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Committee to Protect Journalists has released its annual report on the killing of reporters around the world. From Nairobi, Lenny Ruvaga looks at what the report says about the state of media freedom in Africa.
46-year-old Waweru Mugo has been a journalist in Kenya for the last 15 years and now runs his own media consulting firm. It is not always easy. Last October, Kenyan lawmakers considered a bill that would ban the press from reporting on parliamentary matters. The controversial clauses were eventually removed amid protest from civil society and media organizations. According to Mugo, journalists in Kenya and all of Africa face challenges, especially attempts by governments to intimidate and censor them. This, he says, has limited the growth of a free press.
When you try to highlight some of these issues, the government tries to crack the whip. The government demands that you do ABCD, that you're not supposed to be unpatriotic. They label you as an unpatriotic. They say that you've been bought off by foreign interests. You are working for the opposition. So the journalists also kind of bend the whims of the government through self-censorship.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says 69 journalists around the world were killed while on duty this year. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 69 journalists around the world were killed while on duty this year. Many died at the hands of Islamist militant groups like Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. The biggest number came from Syria, but 11 were killed in Africa, including 5 in war-torn South Sudan. Dr. Felix Odimasi of the School of Law and Diplomacy at the University of Nairobi says the lack of government support makes journalists cautious about reporting from conflict areas like South Sudan, Somalia, and northern Nigeria.
Because one, they would not go out there to report, and two, those who dare to go out and report still know that they are at risk. And so they have to be very careful about what they report about and where they go. It's the general lack or weakness of the rule of law. The laws that exist are not necessarily being followed, and there's no strong legislation in some of these weak states to protect the media.
Members of Africa's Fourth Estate have come under fire across the continent from multiple regimes. Amnesty International says the South African government and ruling African National Congress Party are pushing for a tribunal to regulate the media under the guise of transformation. Amnesty notes that in Ethiopia, many journalists and media workers are currently in prison or have been convicted in absentia because of their work. Benji Ndolo, a civil rights activist from the Kenyan-based Organization of National Empowerment, says a concerted effort from non-state actors is the only way to halt the intimidation.
International processes, civil rights movements, non-governmental organizations, and even church organizations, as well as the media, will push these countries into a corner where they will be held to account for loss of lives. They will not have impunity forever. And so change will come to these countries. Accountability will be there.
Besides South Sudan, other countries where journalists were killed in 2015 included Somalia, Kenya, Libya, and Ghana. Another 5 were killed in Somalia's neighbor Yemen across the Gulf of Aden. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Climate change was a major story in 2015. Earlier this month, nations agreed on a plan to deal with rising global temperatures when they met at the Paris Climate Conference. Among those monitoring the effects of climate change is Harjeet Singh, the climate lead for ActionAid International. From New Delhi, India, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapoor about the effects of rising temperatures in 2015.
Every other year and every other month is now becoming the hottest month and hottest year ever. And the impact of that on changing weather patterns is quite visible. And we have seen how a number of disaster events, drought, typhoons, or flooding events that have increased a number of times over the last few years. And if I talk about Africa in particular, we have seen how El Nino effect intensified the impact in Africa. We have seen drought patterns affecting eastern and southern Africa. So countries like Ethiopia, Somalia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa getting badly affected. And we've also seen heavy rains in Burundi and Nigeria. So Africa as a continent is set to lose a lot when it comes to climate change.
Now, you mentioned El Nino. Can that actually be tied to climate change, or is that a weather phenomenon that works independently of climate change?
Yes, El Nino is an independent phenomenon, but now new studies have clearly linked how climate change is going to intensify El Nino effect. And something which was quite natural phenomenon is now being affected by climate change because it is clearly linked with the warming of oceans. And when we talk about climate change, when we talk about global warming, it's all about how oceans have warmed and how they have changed the whole climate system, or they have disrupted the climate system. And we are seeing that effects of El Nino and La Nina are getting much stronger.
I understand that El Nino has dramatically warmed the oceans. When you talk about climate change and warming oceans, do you address that the same way as you would rising temperatures over land?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's true that El Nino itself as a phenomenon is a challenge for scientists. But more and more studies, as I said, are indicating that warming oceans are clearly intensifying the El Nino effect, and which has a clear impact on the kind of erratic weather patterns we are seeing in different parts of the world.
Let me ask you a little bit about the climate conference that was recently held in Paris. During those negotiations, which finally produced an agreement, there was a great call from developing countries, both in Africa and elsewhere, for financial support to deal with climate change. Do you see that support actually coming?
Well, there's a big question around that. So for developing countries, adapting to climate change is their top priority. You know, when your house is set on fire, the first thing you do is to put out the flames, right? So for them, it's all about dealing with the impacts of climate change, and that's what they have been demanding. They need money to make sure that they have better early warning systems. They need money to make sure that they can build dikes so that they can survive with the rising sea levels or now the increasing flooding. But when it comes to money from developed countries, there are some good words in the Paris deal, but no concrete commitment coming to provide money, which was committed way back in 2009, that they're going to provide $100 billion a year, 2020 onwards.
So what can developing countries actually do to mitigate the effects of climate change?
I think first thing for developing countries is to understand what kind of impacts they are going to face and what kind of systems they need to build. There are countries who don't even have a proper early warning system through which they can inform their people how weather pattern is changing, which has a direct bearing particularly on the agriculture community that needs information on when to sow their crops and when to harvest. If that information reaches, a lot of losses can be minimized. So majority of developing countries, poor developing countries, don't have those systems. Then they also need to stockpile food so that they can provide it to their populations when they are hit by erratic weather patterns. They also need to make sure that their agriculture research is also able to deal with these changing weather patterns. So they need to have seeds which can work when rains are early or when rains are late. And also they are seeing how the salinity is increasing, and they need to have seeds that can deal with that. And they also need to make sure that they have a proper irrigation system. And all these things require a huge amount of investment, you know, starting from research to infrastructure and to build capacity of their own people, and especially, as I said, the farming community to deal with these changes.
Harjit Singh is the climate lead for ActionAid International from New Delhi, India. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapoor. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. There was more violence in northeastern Kenya as two civilians were killed when Kenyan military officers fired on a car in the Mandera region. The World Health Organization declares Guinea free of Ebola. And the Associated Press reports the death toll from two Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria yesterday rose to 80. Coming up, we'll have music from Liberia. And in our feature segment, in Zimbabwe's parliament, it's providing facilities for breastfeeding lawmakers to care for their babies during parliamentary sessions. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some news about African football coaching changes.
Kim, let's kick off with African football. Burkina Faso has signed Portuguese coach Paulo Duarte for a second stint in charge of the national team, nicknamed the Stallions. The 46-year-old Duarte was in charge of the Stallions between 2008 and 2012, during which time he led them to two Africa Cup of Nations finals. His most recent coaching job was with the Tunisian club CS Sfaxien from April to August this year. Duarte replaces the German Gernot Rohr, who returned home last week to work with the German Football Federation. The Stallions of Burkina Faso reached the title game at the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Johannesburg, where they were led by Belgian tactician Paul Put. Burkina Faso lost to Nigeria 1-0 in the final. It was Burkina Faso's best ever showing at the Nations Cup, but the Stallions have lost a bit of their gallop since then. They'll end 2015 ranked 89th in the world, according to FIFA, and 22nd in Africa. Meanwhile, Angola, ranked 28th in Africa and 105th overall to end the year, has fired its coach. Mark Ouma has that story, as well as other football news.
The Angolan Football Federation has sacked their national team coach, Romeo Filmon, the federation revealed in Luanda on Monday. The federation claims he has not resumed work following the Christmas Day break. Trouble has been brewing between the tactician and federation after Filmon publicly aired concern that he allegedly has not received his salary for 8 months. Angola is preparing for the African Nations Championship starting in Kigali, Rwanda, in less than 3 weeks.
Voice of America!
Visiting Egyptians held their Tunisian under-17 peers to a scoreless draw in the second friendly played in Tunis on Monday. Earlier on in the first encounter, Tunisia outclassed Egypt 3-0.
VOA!
Jordanian FIFA presidential candidate Prince Ali bin Al Hussein has called for the immediate publication of the Michael Garcia report on alleged bribery and corruption in the bidding process for the 2018 and 2022 FIFA World Cup tournaments. Al Hussein made his position known while on a campaign stopover in Dubai, United Arab Emirates on Sunday. A former American prosecutor, Garcia resigned as FIFA's chief corruption investigator in protest at FIFA's handling of his report on the decision to award Russia and Qatar the 2018 and 2022 FIFA World Cup events respectively. According to Garcia, there were significant omissions in the summarized report released by FIFA ethics judge Hans Joachim Eckert. Prince Al Hussein stopped short of declaring he would release the full report should he be elected FIFA president on the 26th of February next year.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. In women's football, the United States reigns supreme once again in 2015. The American women won their record third World Cup title, beating defending champion Japan 5-2 in the final on July 5th in Vancouver, Canada. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, let's listen in again to my post-match report. The Americans exploded for four goals during the first 16 minutes of the game. USA captain Carly Lloyd was the player of the match and the player of the tournament. She received the Golden Ball Award given to the best player at the Women's World Cup. After some hat-trick heroics in Vancouver, Carly scored three goals in the first half, finding the net in the 3rd, 5th, and 16th minutes. Lloyd's third goal was my favorite. She dodged a challenge near the center circle, and near midfield, she noticed Japan's goalkeeper, Ayumi Kaori, was at the top of the penalty box. Lloyd launched a wonder strike as Kaori backpedaled, stumbled, and got a hand on it before watching the spectacular shot touch the post and roll into the net. Hey, Carly, how does it feel to be a World Cup champion?
I don't think it's entirely sunk in. I'm so proud and so zapped at the same time. It's a surreal moment. It's been amazing. I mean, we just wrote history today and brought this World Cup trophy home, which is unbelievable. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that I've pushed on my status a little bit and I have to stay up here. So it's not right away, but I'll be back to work and back stronger than ever.
As Carly Lloyd said, the USA wrote history with its third Women's World Cup title. The Americans also won the trophy in 1991 and 1999. They also gained a measure of revenge after losing to the Japanese on penalty kicks in the 2011 final. At the post-match news conference, U.S. coach Jill Ellis praised their Asian opponent.
First, I want to congratulate Japan. They are a tremendous opponent and deserving of always ending up in championship matches. Love how they play.
USA coach Jill Ellis talked with Abby Wambach, one of the greatest female soccer players ever, about taking on a different role at this World Cup. The 35-year-old Wambach came off the bench as a second-half substitute in both the semifinals and final. In the end, Wambach celebrated her first World Cup title.
I'm so happy. I'm emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. I love my teammates. Carly Lloyd, are you kidding me with the effort that she gave tonight? But really, it was a true team effort. Not only just the 23 players, but our staff. It just shows how important every little detail has become.
And speaking of details, let's give a few details now on the award winners at this 7th Women's World Cup in Canada. Carly Lloyd, as I mentioned, won the Golden Ball Award as the best player in the month-long tournament. Lloyd also tied with Germany's Celia Sasic as the top scorer at the Women's World Cup. Each had six goals. Sasic, though, was awarded the Golden Boot based on playing fewer minutes than Lloyd. The Golden Glove Award for top goalkeeper went to American Hope Solo. 19-year-old defender Kadisha Buchanan of Host Canada won the Young Player Award, and the FIFA Fair Play Trophy went to France. In the third-place match at the Women's World Cup, England defeated Germany 1-0 in extra time in Edmonton, Canada. Farrah Williams scored on a penalty kick in the 108th minute for the three Lionesses of England, who had their best ever Women's World Cup showing. After lifting the World Cup trophy, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team went on a victory tour, playing a series of exhibition matches. The tour ended with a 1-0 loss to China earlier this month, the farewell match for veteran American soccer star Abby Wambach. After making her 255th and final international appearance for the world champion USA, the 35-year-old Wambach had this to say.
I love my teammates for wanting to give me the send-off that we all kind of quote-unquote envisioned, but I think it's kind of symbolic, right? I get 70 minutes, and we don't score a goal. For me, it's like, okay, it's time to step away. The symbolism in it for me is amazing, and I know everybody is going to be like, oh, gosh, everybody in the locker room, like, they're just like, I'm so sorry, you know? And I'm like, there's nothing to be sorry about. You know, today wasn't about getting a result. It was about celebrating not just my career, but the chances that I've had with all my other teammates and the time that I've spent with them. And I think everything kind of just hit me that, you know, this was the last time I'd be taking the jersey off. You know, this is the last time I'd be hanging out with my teammates in the locker room. And they're all happy tears, you know? I'm not questioning whether I should retire or not. I know that my career has come full circle. I feel very complete about it. And the future of this team is so bright.
Abby Wambach steps away from the world champion U.S. Women's National Soccer Team as world football's all-time leading scorer, male or female, with 184 goals. Abby was also one of the most outspoken critics of this year's Women's World Cup being played on artificial turf in Canada. Like Wambach, the sunny side of sports hopes all future Women's World Cups are played on natural grass like the men's version. Follow the sunny side of sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a nice photo and article on Meadowlark Lemon, the legendary Harlem Globetrotters basketball player who died Sunday at the age of 83. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Zimbabwe, Parliament providing facilities for breastfeeding lawmakers to take care of their babies during parliamentary sessions. And next, we focus on the obstetric fistula operation campaign in Zimbabwe. But first, some music. Here is Nimba Burr of Liberia with Africa Beat.
Liberia with Africa Beat.
Well, Zimbabwe National Assembly Speaker Jacob Mudenda says Parliament will provide facilities for breastfeeding lawmakers to care for their babies during parliamentary sessions. Our correspondent Erwin Chifora reports from Harare.
Mudenda made the remarks after lawmaker Priscilla Misaira Mbwimushonga of the Movement for Democratic Change Formation led by Professor Walshman Ngube brought a baby in the chamber to complain that Parliament is not women-friendly.
Most of these women that you are going to see in this house are childbearing. And there is nothing here in this Parliament that allows you to bring a baby.
She said Parliament's standing rules and orders have no provision allowing lawmakers time out to breastfeed. Ms. Aira Mumushonga said even the Constitution accords equal opportunities to men and women to participate in political activities, yet parliamentary rules did not provide the same opportunities.
As long as we are hamstrung by inability to be able to do so, because we have to look after them as it is today, it's an important debate today. I don't have anything to do with that, so I have to come here. But I understand because I looked at the standing rules and orders, and there's no provision that allows somebody to bring in a baby.
Mudenda said lawmaker Priscilla Misaira Mbwimushonga's observation was correct and Parliament would provide facilities for nursing legislators to bring babies so that they can participate in debates and go back to breastfeed on Parliament premises. Misaira left the house with a baby after the Speaker's ruling as babies are not allowed in the house. Harare worker Lois Mukombe applauded the decision taken by Parliament.
I think it's very important because, you know, you see there are some women who are professionals who spend most of their times at work, and sometimes they would want to be with their children. Yeah, sometimes they cannot leave them with their maids, and there's a time in which a child has to be with her mother.
Zimbabwe's labor laws grant workers 3 months maternity leave and 1 hour for nursing during working hours after the 3 months, but some friendly companies and organizations provide extra hours for breastfeeding mothers. From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Close to 60 women in Zimbabwe were cured from ailments brought on by fistula thanks to an ongoing obstetric fistula operation campaign that recently wrapped up the year 2015. The campaign was a collaboration between the Women and Health Alliance International, or WAHA, Chinoya Provincial Hospital, the Ministry of Health, and the United Nations. The project assisted women throughout the country, providing free transportation, boarding, consultations, and surgeries by international doctors. Reporter Marvelous Malanga Niawi spoke with Fortune Mabandi, National Outreach Coordinator with Women and Health Alliance International.
It went very well. We managed to operate on about 68 skilled women who had either fecal incontinence or urine incontinence. It went very well.
What is fistula? For some people that may have just tuned in today and want to learn about what kind of operations your organization does.
A fistula is a condition whereby a hole forms within the rectum or the bladder caused by a traumatic birthing experience. By that, I mean you've taken too long before you've given birth or you've been in labor too long. That usually is the end result. You get a fistula where the tissue is now weakened and the bladder cracks open.
So what kind of assistance does your organization offer for women that may be experiencing this?
What we have been doing so far in Zimbabwe as Women and Health Alliance, we've been offering, firstly, transport to bring them to whichever center the ministry has given us to work from. In this case, we're working from Chinoy Provincial Hospital. So we would give them transport from either Kipinge, Buhera, Bikita. It doesn't matter which part of Zimbabwe they're coming from. Would fully sponsor their transport and then would pay in full their hospital bills, including the surgery and the aftercare, which means at least 3 weeks stay in hospital post-operation. Would also provide things like the basic toiletries, because most of them come from a place where they don't actually afford to part with things as simple as a bucket. So we give the basic ablutions on arrival. And we also offer rehabilitation to women who have been repaired. By rehabilitation, we mean for those that are as young as 15 years old, because we've got such patients, we allow them a chance to go back to school to finish either their ordinary level or some sort of certificate to allow them to be able to look after themselves in the future. And for the more mature women, we also allow a communication program of doing either poultry project or blood making, as long as they're able to assist themselves afterwards. That's the kind of rehabilitation we've been offering post-operation.
For those that may want to utilize your services, where can they find you?
Currently, we are based in Harare. What we do is, as we're directed by the ministry, we just go to whichever center. But we're currently taking calls for all those who've got the condition, and they can reach us on 4779-626-506. I'll take it again, 4779-626-506, or another number, 4782-640-840, 4782-640-840. They can either WhatsApp, they can either text, or send a police call to reply to each and every call, because sometimes these women are so marginalized, they don't even have a mobile phone of their own.
So when is your next program, if there are some listening out there who'd actually like to enroll? When do you have the next clinic?
The next camp is most likely going to be in February. We want to also give the institutions we work with a chance to give their members of staff a rest, because our campaigns are so concentrated. So our next camp is most likely in February, but we can't really say, because we've got a lot of other players that are involved. We are now working in collaboration with an arm of the UN, the UNFPA. They deal mainly with maternal health care, and we also work directly under the arm of Ministry of Health and Child Care, Family Health. So all those players, they get to tell us what our next camp is.
The National Outreach Coordinator with Women and Health Alliance International, Fortunate Mabandi, speaking with Marvelous Malanga Niawi of VOA's Zimbabwe service.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2009, President Barack Obama announced that under his administration, the United States would prioritize alleviating global hunger, undernutrition, and poverty. At the time, the global economic recession and rising food prices were forcing ever more people into food insecurity. So at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy that year, President Obama committed an initial $3.5 billion to fight global hunger and poverty. Less than a year later, Feed the Future was born. It is an innovative initiative based on the premise that development efforts are most successful when the beneficiary countries determine their own food security needs and contribute to the effort. Led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, the initiative draws on 10 additional federal departments and agencies and investments from private sector partnerships. Today, it is clear that Feed the Future, coupled with other innovative U.S. government food security initiatives, are helping developing countries make substantial progress against hunger, poverty, and undernutrition. Last year alone, Feed the Future reached nearly 19 million households through assistance or training and helped bring new tools and technologies such as better seeds and fertilizers to nearly 7 million farmers. In fact, over the past 5 years in areas where Feed the Future works, the rate of childhood stunting, which indicates chronic malnutrition and leads to a host of developmental problems, has declined 9% in Ethiopia, 33% in Ghana, 25% in parts of Kenya, 21% in some areas of Cambodia, and 14.4% in areas of Bangladesh. Honduras and Bangladesh have seen a steep drop in poverty rates, and globally more than 12 million children receive nutrition interventions, such as vitamins and nutritional supplements, to help them grow and thrive. Much of the improvement has come as a result of Feed the Future's cooperation with a wide range of stakeholders to help smallholder farmers address the root causes of food insecurity and to increase economic opportunities. Through Feed the Future, the United States is partnering across borders and across sectors to unlock the transformative potential of agriculture, said USAID Associate Administrator Eric Postel. From Asia to the Caribbean to Africa, Feed the Future is helping raise crop yields and incomes, reduce stunting and poverty, and improve child nutrition. Going forward, USAID and our partners will continue working to ensure everyone has the nutritious food they need to lead full, healthy lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.